He continued his shiuring gemerach. The gemerach says Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi said three things in the name of the elders of Yerushalayim, the wise men of Yerushalayim. First, he said, if a man has a daughter, his primary concern should be to marry off that daughter. And if that daughter reaches a certain age that is dangerous, he still has not married her off. Which age is that? According to the Gemara, the age of 12 and a half, 12 years and 6 months, that means that she is already considered like an old maid. Then in desperation, he should even free his slave in order to marry her off, even to this slave. The lesson, of course, is that a person should know that the greatest burden is an unmarried daughter, and he should not be too particular in selecting a mate. Of course, we have learned that a man should sell everything he has in order to get a son-in-law who is a Talmid Chacham, certainly. But if he has searched high and wide for one, rather than leave his daughter remain single, chas v'shalom, then take the next best thing or the next, and so on. Above all, get the daughter married off. Secondly, Rabbi Shmuel Levi said, be careful about staying on roofs. Staying on a roof is dangerous, not because he might fall off, but because a roof is a high place, and he might see other roofs that are lower. And other roofs that are lower, he might see women there, and we find that the whole trap set for King David was through a roof. Once going on the roof of the palace, he saw Bathsheba, and so this brought about a desire and led to the whole story of King David and Bathsheba. In that case, of course, there was nothing wrong, chas v'shalom. It was an act of kedusha. King David was pure throughout. It was done to teach people the power of teshuvah. But it shows, though, how risky it is to be on a roof where a person who was not that strong spiritually, who could not resist temptation, might see things which may lead him into chas v'shalom sin. Third, Rabbi Yehoshua Levi said, be careful of your first son-in-law in reference to your wife, because a mother-in-law marries off a daughter and is very affectionate to her son-in-law. She too appreciates the fact that her daughter is now being taken care of by her husband, and there's an additional amount of affection shown by a mother-in-law to a son-in-law. This can manifest itself in a very expensive manner. She might be overindulgent and spend a lot of money and gifts for her son-in-law, more than her husband can afford. Therefore, the Gemara says, be careful about your first son-in-law. See to it that your wife doesn't spend too much, doesn't go overboard for him. We had mentioned before about matters of business, and one item that we should include previously. The Gemara says that, this is one of Rav's statements before, that it is better a small pot from the ground rather than a bushel full from the top floor. The meaning is, it is better to earn a little bit money close by, which means you don't have to leave home or leave your hometown, rather than earn a lot if you've got to go a far distance for it. You can earn a little satisfactory living in your own hometown. Do that rather than the prospects of making a lot of money by leaving town, going away from home. There's nothing that makes it worthwhile to leave home, go out of town to earn more money. This is the advice of the Gemara. A lot of people would do well to take heed of this advice. The Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan said, there are three people who inherit Olam Haba, Gan Eden. One, he who lives in Eretz Yisrael. The mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael is so great that he inherits Gan Eden. Note the word he inherits, because we have learned in the Gemara that one who walks 4 steps, 4 amot in Eretz Yisrael receives a chilek, a part in Gan Eden. Inherits means that he's closer, he's related to it. Like one who's related, a blood relation, he is part of it. He becomes part of Gan Eden. It's actually his by inheritance, which means much more than just receiving a chilek, meaning he is a stranger. And this is for one who lives in Eretz Yisrael. Second is one who raises his children in the study of Torah. He does not spare expense or effort in seeing that his children go to yeshiva. A person who raises his children in that manner, see that his children go to yeshiva rather than sending them out to business at an early age, this person becomes part of, he inherits Olam Haba. Third is a person who makes Havdalah on wine every Saturday night. Meaningly, at the end of Shabbat, he makes Havdalah on wine, he inherits Olam Haba. Every person does this. This, of course, means that the person who cannot afford the wine, person who is short on wine, rather than drink that wine, have the pleasure of drinking it during Shabbat, he leaves that wine over so he can have the important mitzvah of making Havdalah on wine after Shabbat is over. Rabbi Yochanan said, Hashem announces each day about three types of people. In other words, Hashem is proud of these three. One is a davek. Davek means an unmarried man who lives in a large city and does not commit sins, meaning he does not go to places where he might be tempted with women. He does not go to with women that he shouldn't. He does not go to places where he might see things that would tempt him, arouse him. And the fact that he is unmarried, he doesn't have a home or wife to go to. Still, despite this, he refrains completely from any contact with anything pertaining to women. This is an item that Hashem himself announces with pride about this person in heaven. Second is a poor man who is very poor and he finds a lost article, which rightfully he may keep. There's no simen, but he knows the owner, and he returns this lost article to the owner. This poor man, despite the fact that he is so poor, and this lost article is something, is money, for example, he could use for food to himself, still he returns it. This shows an unusual degree of honesty. Third is a wealthy man who gives ma'aser, the tenth of his earnings, of his property, and does so secretly. He doesn't come out and show, here is $1,000 by ma'aser. He could pride himself, boast of the large amounts that he gives. Ma'aser is compulsory for everyone. But a rich man come out openly and say, look at the tremendous amount this that guy give. This is my ma'aser, announced to a fortune. 1,000, 10,000 or more, depending upon his wealth. If he does this secretly, this is something that makes Hashem proud. These three items, notice, why just these three? There are a lot of mitzvot in Torah. These three represent the person who overcomes the three types of temptations that exist. One is the ta'ava for women, and the most outstanding one is an unmarried man who does not allow temptation to defeat him. Second is ta'ava for money, especially a poor man who is in such dire need of it. Despite this, he does not allow the yitzhara to persuade him to keep this lost article. He returns it to the owner. Third is the ta'ava for kavod, honor, people to respect him. That's the case of a rich man who gives his ma'asid, where he could receive so much honor for his philanthropy. Still, he does it secretly. Yehuda says that the Rav Safra was unmarried. He lived in a large city, and he was sitting together with the Rava when this statement was made. Rav Safra's face lit up, and he said, wonderful, this means that I am so important, Hashem announces about me in heaven each day. Rava said to him, not like you. Your case is not what the Gemara means. Your case is simple. You live in a big city, but you sit in the yeshiva all day and learn. That's no big accomplishment. You're not actually overpowering, battling against the Yitzhara. This refers to a case like Rav Hanina and Rav Oshia, who sold shoes in the marketplace. Then it just said, in a certain place, this was a market where Zonot used to come a lot, and they had shoes for women. These women would enter their shop, and they would try on his shoes, but they would never raise their eyes to look at these women customers. These are the holy rabbis of Eretz Yisrael. This is what the Gemara refers to. Gemara says there are three people that Hashem likes very much. One, person who never allows himself to fall into chaos, never allows himself to lose his temper. Second, a person who never allows himself to overindulge in intoxicating beverages, become drunk. And third, most of all, person who is forgiving very quickly. Anyone insults him, he does not keep a grudge, he forgives immediately. These are the three that Hashem likes with affection. There are three that Hashem dislikes. One is a person who speaks with his mouth what he does not think in his heart. He thinks one thing and says something else, meaning that he falsifies. Second is a person who knows testimony for his friend and refuses to testify, thereby his friend could lose that case. Third, a person who sees his friend do something that is wrong, disgraceful, shameful, and he testifies against him alone. Now, testifying is considered effective only when there are two witnesses. But if there's only one witness, it means nothing. It means that this person accomplished nothing more than to speak Lashon Hara against a Jew. The Gemara says, for example, a beautiful illustration. There were two people. One man's name was Tuvia. The second was Zigut. Case happened with these two men. Tuvia committed a sin, whatever the sin was. Then Zigut came before that papa. He testified as a witness. He had seen Tuvia commit this crime. The papa said, give this man malkut, lashings. Lash this witness. Zigud looked up in surprise and said these famous words. Tuvia sins, Zigud gets lashed for it. What kind of a justice is this? He commits the sins and I get beaten up? The papa answered, yes, that's right, because you came yourself to testify. All you're doing is just speaking Lashon Hara against the Jew. We cannot accept your testimony, which means that there's no question of truth about what you say. It's only Lashon Hara. For that, you get 39 lashes, because there's a pasuk in the Torah which says, one witness shall not have any effect against the person. He shall not rise up to testify against the man. The Gemara asks, what if there are two students? The case with the rabbi. One student sees another student committing a wrong. Is the student allowed to report this act to the rabbi about the other student? The Gemara answers, the Rashi answered, yes, if the rabbi believes this student implicitly, he knows that he is honest and will not tell a lie, then he should report this to the rabbi. If not, if the rabbi has any doubts about the student's honesty, then he should not report this because then it's considered only Lashon Hara. He then says there are three people whose lives are not considered living. You cannot call them living. One, person who has an overabundance of kindness, pity upon others. He has so soft a heart that whenever someone comes to him with a problem, he'll give away whatever he has, so that he never has a life of his own. Whoever comes to him with need of anything, he will go out of his way, work, money, effort, and therefore it will lead to others to come to him too. He'll never lead a life of his own. Second is a person who is extremely temperamental, who has fits of temper. But this person lives a life of chaos, which affects his heart, his nerves, and he does not lead a normal life. Third is a person who has a depressed mind. He's continually moody or sensitive, and everything irks him. If something is not exactly just right, then he becomes frustrated. He becomes hurt, and at no time does this person have peace of mind. These three people are considered as though they do not have a life to lead like other people. A life is not their own. Then it says, no, there are four people who the human mind cannot conceive, cannot understand them, or better still, cannot tolerate them. They don't make sense, and in a sense, they are disgusting. There's a person who is very poor. Now, poor generally means poor in money. Even it says elsewhere that poor really means poor in mentality, in wisdom. Yisroel HaKadosh says poor always means poor in Torah and Mitzvot, knowledge. In any case, either one of these applies here. Person is very poor, and he has gaveh, conceit, haughtiness. This the mind cannot understand, cannot tolerate. Person who has a lot, wealth, wisdom, strength, we can understand why he has conceit. It's wrong, but it could be understood. Here it doesn't make sense at all. He's poor. What has he got to be conceited about? It's a sin and there's no reason for it. No logical reason why he should have conceit. This is something that sort of disgusts the human mind. Second is a case of a very wealthy man who lies in order to cheat for money, for a small change. He's very wealthy. Why be a cheat to this petty items? This the mind cannot tolerate. Third is a case of an old man who commits sins with women. Understood that committing sins with women is, Chas v'Shalom, a serious crime for any person, no matter how young. At least it makes sense. It's logic. A young person has that temptation. But that an old man should do this, this does not bear out according to logic. Fourth is the case of a leader of a city or a community, who acts too strictly with the community for no reason at all. In other words, he forces them to pay taxes, to perform certain duties, only for his benefit. When it comes to the needs of the community, he doesn't do anything to help them in return. This makes no sense. If he's a leader, he shows his leadership, he should show it at a time when the community can benefit. There are some rabbis who say that we add to this also, there's no logic behind a man who divorces his wife, and then remarries her, and then divorces her a second time, and then remarries her. In other words, he should make up his mind once and for all. He wants her, keep her. If not, get rid of her. Pimena says this is not something that's not logical, because there can be a case where the ketubah, the marriage contract, is so large that he divorced her, hoping to get rid of her, but he finds that he could not raise the necessary money. So rather than being hack, he figured it was cheaper to take his wife back. Then he tried a second time. Or a case where he has children. He thought he could divorce her and get along with the children, but he finds that it's impossible. So for the children's sake, he's forced to take her back. Even it says there are certain people who are considered in chidim, in heaven, where heaven itself places these people in chidim. Not on earth, but heaven itself does that. So there'll be heavenly chidim declared in heaven against these people. One is a man who is not married, who takes his time about it, who is not anxious, and lets time slip away without searching, bending every effort to finding a wife. If he tries hard, he doesn't have hatzlacha, doesn't have mazal of finding a wife, at least he has tried. Or one who doesn't try, one who is indifferent about it, this person has against him a heavenly chidim, as is shown. Second is a man who is married but doesn't have children and doesn't strive for it, at least to pray as hard as possible. If there's nothing he can do about it physically, at least to tefillah, at least to desire it, to do whatever is possible in his power. And if he doesn't, then he is in a heavenly chidim. Even as says, even if it requires divorcing a wife, the olden days, if a man was married for 10 years, and then it's Yisrael, and his wife didn't give birth, it was customary to divorce her. That was the old term. Third is a man who has children and does not provide the study of Torah for them. He doesn't raise them in learning Torah. Fourth is a man who does not, anyone who does not put on tefillin on the head and the arm. Fifth is a man who does not wear tzitzit. He considers it unimportant, chas v'shalom. He figures it's enough to put it on in the morning for sewing. The rest of the day, he is mezalzel, considers it very unimportant. He degrades the important mitzvah of tzitzit. And the person who is not particular about seeing that his doors, every door in his home, should have a mezuzah. Also, one who just goes without shoes. This we had mentioned before too, the mitzvah of wearing shoes and how wrong it is to go without shoes. But in all these cases, even it adds here, there is a heavenly chidim placed upon this person in heaven. Lastly, some rabbis say this also refers to a person who refuses to participate in a su'udat mitzvah, a feast, a festive occasion of mitzvah, like a brit milah or a chatuneh, where it's a mitzvah to attend, a kiddush, so on. Otherwise, a person should be very careful not to fall into any one of these categories, that's for sure. Yemena says, in word for onions is batsel in Hebrew. Batsel is onions, and the word for shadow or shade is tsel, and the shadow is bitsel. This sort of rhymes, batsel and bitsel. Yemena says, eat onions, meaning eat vegetables. Do not spend too much money on your food. Don't be too elaborate. And you'll know that you can live in the shade of your home freely without worrying about people coming to demand money from you. Collectors, creditors coming to take your home away. Your home will be safe. Do not eat batty foods, expensive foods. Because then you'll always be worried about creditors having spent too much money. Plus the fact that you always have developed a taste for these things, you'll find it at times an expense that's greater than you can bear. One is accustomed to eating cheaper foods, it doesn't bother him. One is not. That person suffers with his food unless he has the type of food he's accustomed to. Even as there's two now, an important question that is in the mind of many people. If you have a limited amount of money, spend less for food and more for a home. It is more important to spend lavishly on the home and less on food, which seem to us the contrary. You take care of your body physically more than you would of your house. The U.S. says that it is more important to spend the money, greater portion of money, ratio, of course, naturally, ratio, greater upon the home and less on food, because you'll be able to sustain yourself with a little less food, less expensive food. And the food that you've eaten is enough nourishment while you can then enjoy a beautiful home, better than to spend the money on food, which after you've eaten it is gone, and have a home that does not give you the peace of mind that a nice apartment or home would. The Yemena says that they said a mashal, example, Eretz Yisrael. A word for expensive meat is alita. It's like the tail part of the animal. It's the most expensive part that is brought usually on the mizbeach, on the altar. And the word for upstairs, the attic, is ilita. Again, it rhymes. The Yemena says, one who eats alita, expensive food, he has to hide in the attic, because he'll always be in debt to creditors. Overspending for food will find him in debt. He'll have to hide out from people. He cannot be able to face people. The one who eats kakuli, that means vegetables, the cheapest type of food, and akikla, which means in the open marketplace, he can sit anywhere in the city, in the marketplace, in front of the large crowds of people, sit there peacefully without the slightest worry of any creditors, because he will not owe people any money. Abedazal said one word, that it is better to be in debt to yourself. Owe yourself a meal, owe yourself a garment, owe yourself a luxury, meaning don't spend it on yourself, and you owe it to yourself, rather than do spend it on yourself and owe it to others, to creditors. A person should sacrifice a lot of things, luxuries and even necessities if necessary, not to borrow and to be indebted to others, because one of the worst experiences in life is a balchov, one who is in debt, that's for sure. The Yemena says that King David always said Mizmor David. Mizmor means a prayer by King David, but this refers to a prayer said with the Shekhinah resting upon it. Mizmor David or David Mizmor, difference when he started with the Shekhinah upon him, or whether he started first and the Shekhinah came after he started. There's a machloket, by the way, between the Gemara and the Zohar HaKadosh, which one came first. But the Gemara says that this teaches us that Mizmor, of course, means a song of happiness, which shows that the Shekhinah does not rest upon a person who is sad, or who is lightheaded, or who speaks words of unimportance, or words that are wasted, that don't have any kedusha in them. The Shekhinah will only rest upon a person who is in the act of performing a mitzvah with simcha, not where there is chas v'shalom atzvut or sadness. The Gemara asks, but we have learned that when a student sits in front of a rabbi, he's supposed to be very serious. No laughter, no act of simcha, which means no lightness, happiness. The opposite of happiness means not just sad, but serious, extremely serious. Even answers, that's true.
was speaking about. The difference is that the student must be extremely serious. The rabbi should be with simcha. Simcha means a little bit lighter than serious. Yemena says, but even in a rabbi too, there are two cases. When he is teaching Torah, it must be in extreme seriousness. Before he begins, then he should show simcha. And as an example, the Gemara says at the Rabba, when he had to begin his shiur, it was the words of Halacha, he would always begin with sort of a light statement, like a joke, to make the bring the students into a good mood. Then he would sit with fear and awe and open his mouth and begin words of Torah. So we say simcha means at first with simcha, then when the Shekhinah comes upon a person, which means today when he starts to speak words of Torah, which are the words of Hashem, then he should be extremely serious. Yemena explains the Pasuk, Hodu LaHashem Ki Tov, praise to Hashem who is good. Good means that which he gives to a person. Shefa, blessings he gives to a person. Also, good means forgiving a person's sins, at times through Yisurim. Both are the same goodness. In other words, Hashem gives to a rich man wealth. What is wealth? Cows. Oxen, they're very expensive, they cost hundreds of dollars. When Hashem wants to punish the wealthy man, he takes away his oxen from him. So, according to the measure of wealth, that's how he punishes him. A poor person, poorer than the rich man, has only a lamb. Hashem gives him the lamb, and the punishment takes the lamb away from him. An orphan, it's a matter of just an egg. A widow, a chicken, each one in ratio measurement. Hashem does not punish the poorest by taking away a tremendous amount, but the rich were taking away a small amount. That which he favored him with, he granted him, this is what he takes away in punishment. But Hodu LaHashem, praise Hashem Ki Tov, because he is good. In that goodness that he gives, that's what he shows goodness in forgiving for a sin by taking that back in return. Rabbi Yochanan said, earning a living is not simple. As I say, it's very difficult to earn a living, to make a dollar. How difficult? Rabbi says that there's a famous word. That word is oi. Oi means a deep sigh. Oh, how hard it is to make a dollar. How hard, how deep is that oi? We know that a woman who gives birth, there's a special chapter in Tehillim, L'Natzeach Mezmura David Ya'ancha Hashem V'yom Sarah, chapter 20. This chapter has 70 words. This is the chapter for only giving birth. And the Yemena says this shows that a woman has to scream 70 times before she finally gives birth. He goes through these labor pains. So this oi of a woman giving birth 70 times is only half of the oi of a person who has to earn a living. It's twice as hard to earn a living as it is for a woman to give birth. You gotta sigh twice as many times oi before he can make a living. And you know, that adds, it's just as difficult for a person to make a living, to receive his livelihood, as the difficulty of dividing the waters of the Red Sea. It's as much of a miracle to have a person receive Shefa as it was to divide the waters of the Red Sea, Kriyat Yamsuf, which was the biggest miracle of all time. And of course, the key to this, naturally, is Bitachon. A person who has confidence, faith in Hashem, he will have this livelihood easy, just as the Jews who had faith when they stood at the Red Sea. Those who had faith knew that there was nothing to worry about because they believed implicitly that Hashem would provide them with this miracle. So to a person who has pure bitachon, pure faith in Hashem, he has this livelihood simply because to him, dividing the waters of the Red Sea was not difficult at all. For Hashem, miracle is not difficult. He leaves it to Hashem to provide this miracle for him, miracle of receiving a living. It says, Hashem is not ten lechem lechol basar. Hashem provides for everyone. I believe that, and I await with confidence this shefa, this downpour of money and necessities. Yehuda says, the pasuk says, V'emet Hashem le'olam, Hashem is truth forever. This pasuk was composed by, said by, a Malach Gavriel, the angel of fire. Of course, at the time that King Amidah fell, or known as King Nimrod, Menashe threw Avraham Avinu into the pit of fire, and this Malach came before Hashem, And he said, Hashem, let me go down and rescue this tzaddik, this one tzaddik, from this pit of fire. Hashem said, no, I am Hashem Echad, I am one. Abraham is one. He is one tzaddik in the world now. It is fitting for one to rescue one. I will personally rescue Abraham Avinu. Hashem rescued Abraham Avinu from this fire. But Hashem does not refuse, does not hold back reward for one who deserves it. Here was a malach who wanted to perform the mitzvah of saving the tzaddik of the world, Abraham Avinu. So he deserved a reward, and Hashem said, I will pay you back for this, for your good intentions. There will come a time when there will be three descendants of this tzaddik who will have the same experience before them, and I will give you the opportunity that these three were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, friends of Daniel the Nabi, who when the king of Babel threw them into the fire. Then a malach Yurka came before Hashem. He was the angel of ice, and said, Hashem, allow me to go down to make turn this fire into ice, cool it for these three tzaddikim. Again, this Malach Gavriel came, Malach of fire, and said, that's no trick. There's no miracle there. The angel of ice to turn off the fire is no big miracle. I am the angel of fire. But me go to that. If people will stage you there, they'll try to walk into or come to this wall of fire, they'll be destroyed. Hashem said, you go down, you deserve it, because I promised you that you'll be given the opportunity to save three descendants. That was when the Malach said, Emet Hashem li olam. Hashem's word is true forever. Generations later, Hashem keeps his word. We find in the Tehillim, King David says many times the Pasuk Lamanat Sayach Mizmor David. What does Lamanat Sayach mean? Nitzachon means victory. One who battles against another one and defeats him. Victory. Who is the victor in this case? What is this battle? Who are we speaking to? This is a prayer to Hashem. Lamanat Sayach, the person praying, is winning a victory against Hashem. And Mizmor means happy, very happy about it. Who is happy? Hashem. The defeated, Kaviyachol, is happy that he's being defeated. The Rebbe says, look at how different the Midah, quality of Hashem, is than that of human beings. If a human being is defeated, he's very sad. But Hashem accepts defeat, and he is happy. What kind of defeat is this? The person who is in the wrong and wants to exonerate himself, to purify himself, he comes before Hashem, and he wants to battle for his forgiveness. He prays hard. He wins over against the heavenly decree. He should be punished. He wins over by doing it. He should be praying to Hashem. Hashem is very happy to Kaviyachol be defeated in this battle. This person prayed so hard and won out on this victory. That's why the Rebbe says this pasuk by Yechezkel Hanavi. When he saw the Maaseh Merkava, famous vision of the copper angels in heaven, they said he saw there a hand beneath the wings of the angels. What does that mean? A hand under the wings of the angels. The Rebbe says this means that these are angels who are avenging angels against the person who is a sinner, and it is their duty, their mission, to destroy him, chas v'shalom, to punish him. But beneath their wings, hidden there, kaviyachol, is the hand of Hashem that is stretched out to accept, to receive a person who wants to do teshubah. Despite these attacking angels, hiddenly, Hashem leaves the room open, a receiving arm, receiving hand, to take these people who want to come back. And Hashem accepts them, protects them from these avenging angels, angels of din, of harsh decrees. Hashem accepts these Ba'alei Teshubah, protects them, and elevates them to a level above din, the level of chesed, kindness of Hashem. The Rebbe says that when Yosef HaTzadik was in Egypt, every country came to him to purchase food. They had to pay for it, silver or whatever precious item they had exchanged for this food. It says that every country that came emptied their coffers, the treasures, into Egypt. That means that Yosef Tzaddik had the treasures of the entire world. And that's why when the Jews left Egypt, they left with wealth, because there was that much gold and silver in Egypt. But besides his wealth, Yosef HaTzadik hid three tremendous treasures in Egypt. One of these treasures was found by Korach. Korach was that evil person who rebelled against Moshe Rabbeinu, and he was extremely wealthy, extraordinarily wealthy, because of this treasure he found. He was the man who the earth swallowed up when he rebelled against Moshe Rabbeinu. Second was found by the Roman king, Antoninus. The third is hidden. When Mashiach comes, this will be given to Tzadikim. It means it's a higher type of treasure. But the Yemen says, King Solomon says, there are times when wealth can prove to be a person's undoing. Wealth can destroy its owner, Chas v'Shalom. Not always is wealth a good factor. It can lead a person to sin, can take a person away from Torah, away from learning, into the wrong type of life. How wealthy was Korach? The Gemara says that there were 300 mules that were loaded with just the keys of Korach's treasures. 300 mules carrying these keys. Now imagine if they had to have 300 mules carrying keys, how many vast storage houses of wealth he had. This is what the Gemara says. There are hidden translations to this. A Musar, not kind of a Musar translation, this will say his shortest, sharpest interpretation is simply that why did Korach have to have 300 camels loaded with keys? How do you find the right key to the right place? And why not have just one solid strong box or 10 keys? Why so many keys? The answer is that he had one strong box, of course, but he had to have 300 doors or 300 doors times that many keys as found on each camel in order to get to this strong box. This was done because he was so miserly. When a poor man came to him for some money, he said to him, yes, wait, I've got to open my strong box. By the time he got to open up these thousands of doors, keys, poor man either died or he left in disgust. That's how he saved the expense of giving out charity. And this, of course, teaches us that a person who is zochet to money should see to it that it is spent properly, with wisdom, giving to the right places, not to allow the money to be master over him, chas v'shalom. He should be master over the money, knowing that this is a blessing that Hashem gave to him for a reason. He used this money wisely in the serving of Hashem. Through tzedakah, using the money for Torah, his children's learning Torah, to distribute it among those who study Torah, and to use it for the sake of the expenses of Shabbat, Yom Tovim, and Mitzvot. Money on this world is a very great treasure because you can buy a lot of Mitzvot, a lot of Gan Eden money, if it is used wisely. We should be zoche who accept this advice to live according to the wisdom of the Torah, and to this to gain for ourselves the our chedek in Olam Haba, be zoche during our lifetime to see the coming of Mashiach, v'yad bet ha-mikash, v'heira b'yamenu, amin v'yamir. We gain for ourselves our chedek in Olam Haba, be zoche during our lifetime to see the coming of Mashiach, v'yad bet ha-mikash, v'heira b'yamenu, amin v'yamir.